This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. For 4 years now, we've brought you lectures, radio shows, and more as a public service of Wordcast Productions. Democrat Tom Perriello achieved what almost no one thought he could do. He defeated Republican incumbent Virgil Good in the 5th District by only 745 votes. What were the factors that led to Perriello's victory? On January 5, 2009, the group Left of Center sponsored a panel discussion to explore that very question and to look ahead to what it means for Democrats in the 5th District. The event was held at Rapture on the downtown mall. Before we begin, let me remind everyone that the Charlottesville Podcasting Network is a nonpartisan organization. Our recording begins with Brevi Cannon, a member of Left of Center's steering committee.
All right, well, probably most people in the room know the basics of what Tom pulled off, but just in case there's a few of us who don't, I'm going to go over the basics. That Tom's victory over Virgil Good has been called one of the top 10 political upsets of the year by Politico, and similar accolades from the Washington Post, Slate, American Prospect, and several other commentators. Virgil was a six-term incumbent. He never won an election with less than 6% of the vote. Tom was down by 30 points with about 90 days to go. And he pulled it off and won by 745 votes out of 315,000 cast. After the and no small part due to some of the people here tonight that you're going to meet in just a minute. We've got six speakers tonight, so I'm just going to introduce them as they get ready to speak, rather than get lost in six different people. And we're going to start off with Brian Bills on the left there. And Brian was Tom's personal assistant for the fall of the campaign after it started out working with the Common Good Summer Program during the summer and decided to take the fall off from Yale to be part of something that I think you could tell was special by that point. And I know he doesn't have any regrets about taking the semester off. I know I think probably some Perriello folks are having some regrets that he's going back this semester, but that's actually why we scheduled the event tonight, because Brian, Rachel, and a lot of others involved with the campaign are going to be at Tom's swearing-in tomorrow night up in D.C., and Brian is heading off to Yale straight from there. So, Brian, why don't you talk a little about the campaign?
Well, thank you very much, Brevi, and thank you for putting this together. I know you were tireless in your efforts to hound me down and find a time I could actually make this, and I really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
First, I should just clarify, I am no longer with the Perriello campaign. What I'm saying now is what I'm saying sort of as a private citizen. And so... That disclaimer aside, at 745 was the correct number back in November, but now we're at 727 votes that we won by. But at such a tiny margin, 0.24% of the vote, a lot of things can be credited with our victory. And first, I'm kind of interested in talking about some of the things that I've heard floated around, especially on a lot of the national blogs, stuff like that, about how Tom won. And the first of those, obviously, which contains a lot of truth, but you know, is also an oversimplification, is the Barack Obama phenomenon. Having Barack Obama on the ticket was helpful. His campaign was remarkably well run, as everyone here is probably aware. I'm sure probably every single person in this room interacted with the Obama campaign in some way. It was really just stellar. They had a great field operation. We coordinated our work very closely with them, which was a huge help. We were one of the few congressional races in Virginia that they were willing to coordinate so closely with because of some of the stuff our campaign had done earlier. One thing worth pointing out, though, is that across the country, Barack Obama was on the ticket in every single state, obviously, and 178 Republicans still won re-election to Congress. So Barack Obama's sort of wave was not a magic ticket in for Tom, and people who sort of attribute the whole thing to that are oversimplifying a little bit. And one of the things that I brought along today in our very high-tech presentation is, if you can see, is a chart comparing vote totals across Virginia, Obama versus the Democratic congressional candidate in that district. We were the only opposed congressional candidate to get more votes than Barack Obama in our district. Nobody else did it. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about the Obama wave. There's also a lot of talk about the Mark Warner's presence on the ticket, which was awesome. Mark Warner's great. Love him. He is a god in Southside. I worked in Martinsville over the summer, which is in the southwestern corner of the district, for those of you who are familiar with it, right by the North Carolina border. You know, having Warner on the ticket was great. He was, however, very focused on his own race and on achieving a very strong mandate, on making sure, you know, that he had the strongest mandate he could going up to Washington. And he, along with a lot of folks, didn't really think that Tom had much of a shot. And so, unlike the Obama campaign, the Warner campaign was slightly less interested in, you know, sort of helping us out, merging field operations, doing stuff like that. And you know, Warner was on the ticket in all of these places as well. Just for as an example, on Andrea Miller, not sure I got her name right, in the district just to the east of us, sort of the southeastern part of the district, had Obama on the ticket in front of her, had Mark Warner on the ticket in front of her, and underperformed Barack Obama significantly. She only got about 40.36% of the vote. Barack Obama and Mark Warner were awesome. It was great to be on a ticket with them. They were not, however, you know, a free ride in for Tom. Having talked about that a little bit, I'd like to talk about a couple of the things that our campaign did a little differently. And I'm very eager to do a question and answer. I think that's going to be a lot more fun. There are a couple things that I just want to throw out there. And it's the three C's, candidate, campaign, and conviction politics. Which I will talk about in that order. So first, the candidate, who I had the pleasure of living with for August, September, October, like 4.5 months or so. Great guy. I love him. One of the many things about Tom is that he's just, I mean, just to start off with, he's just a very impressive guy. And you get this from his biography, obviously. At age 28, he ended a civil war in Sierra Leone. Not all of us have done that. Just really, really impressive. But it's not just the biography. We've run candidates with a very impressive biography in the past. Tom just came across as congressional. And I don't know what it was. I can't quantify it to you. I can't explain it in a, you know, in a mathematical or scientific way, but there was just something he had. Charisma, talent, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but he was just clearly of a different class from a lot of the people that you meet. And that was really impressive. He was very authentic. I can tell you he actually does like country music from riding in the truck. Much to my chagrin, that is not just something, an air he puts on. He's a very down-to-earth person. I'll talk about that a little more when I talk about conviction politics. He's smart, and he's okay with it. He doesn't feel the need to dumb himself down. Jessica, our communications director, bless her heart, would be driven nuts sometimes listening to Tom in these interviews going on about, you know, how Al-Qaeda wanted a reunited Sunni caliphate and Saddam Hussein was opposed to that, or, you know, debt-to-equity ratios and how the ballooning debt-to-equity ratios in the market just, you know, were the root cause of this financial crisis. And he was able to do it in a way that was accessible to people without sort of pandering or dumbing down or sort of talking to people as if they were stupid. He was fantastic in a living room setting. There are a couple events he just blew out of the water. There was this one in Martinsville after the election even with a bunch of teachers down there that one of the local education administrators put together for us. And he's just, he feels very comfortable in sort of a living room setting, in a smaller group setting, and people just got really bought in situations like that. Now, obviously, there were 315,000 votes out there, and not everyone got to meet Tom, but the people who did, I think, really spread the word, and I think that was really important to us. A couple of the negatives, which I will go into, although not in as much detail, because I love Tom. He was very authentic, which could be a problem at times. I remember one particular instance at the Greene County Fair over towards the end of the summer, beginning of the fall, I guess it was. And Tom went to the fair, and he would sit around chatting with people for like 15 minutes. But there were literally 1,000 people at this fair who he would not have spoken to. and we would try and be like, Tom, you just got to shake hands. Hey, I'm Tom Perriello. Nice to meet you. Hey, I'm Tom Perriello. He didn't like that. It didn't feel authentic to him. He got more comfortable with that and sort of figured out, you know, a comfort zone with that stuff more and more as the campaign went on. But that was, you know, that was definitely something. Another thing that I'll mention is he had a very strong vision for the campaign. And overall, I think this was a huge positive. You know, I'm going to talk about this, like I said, a little more in conviction politics. One of the things that did mean, though, was he was reluctant to let big decisions be made by other people. And the, one of the most valuable things you have on a campaign is your candidate's time. And, you know, there would be times when Tom would be, you know, involved in campaign strategy, and I would be desperately, desperately wishing he would cold call his old Yale Law School friends who he hadn't seen in 10 years and beg them for money. And, you know, he just had a different set of priorities from that, which I respect, drove me a little nuts at times. But in the end, like I said, I think him having a vision for the campaign was very important. But there were some drawbacks to that. So that's the first C, candidate. The second C was campaign. The word I would describe our campaign with, if I had to just pick one, would be tireless. We traveled tens of thousands of miles in the truck. It would not be unusual for us to wake up for a 6:30 a.m. start, drive down to Danville for a breakfast, from Charlottesville over to, say, South Boston to meet with some folks over there. From there on to South Hill. You know, we would have these massive days, starting very early, ending very late, get up the next day, do it again. There are no weekends on campaigns. There are no days off. And Tom is just a really driven guy. And so were so many of the people on our campaign. Our campaign had some of the most impressive staff I've ever seen. Lise Clavel, our campaign manager, she started out as our finance director. She was just good at everything she did. And eventually, she became the campaign manager. We had Jessica Barber, our communications director, absolutely phenomenal. Our field staff, among them Rachel Klarman, were top notch. And that's really important. And there are a lot of campaigns that I think Waldo has a term for them. Waldo, where are you? Resume padding campaign monkeys. A lot of campaigns get a lot of those. We managed to avoid that. And one of the ways was we didn't really, nobody on our campaign got paid much. And everyone on the campaign sacrificed a lot to be doing it. Whether it was a semester at school like Rachel and I, whether it was a lot of money, whether it was having a life. And I think that meant that we only attracted people who were not interested in resume padding campaigns, who were interested in a cause that they believed in. And this was a particularly easy cause to believe in, to be fair. One other thing that I'll mention on the campaign side of things, well, two other things, I guess. Tom is a firm believer in field operations. And the unwritten, the sort of the open secret in politics is that most consultants will write off field. They'll tell you field can maybe boost you 1 or 2 points, but really just save all your money and run a lot of TV ads. That's the way to go. And Tom wasn't interested in this. He got into the campaign, like I said, with a very strong vision for what he wanted to see happen. So one of the things we did was Common Good Summer, which, as Brevi mentioned, I was involved with. That was recruiting 15, 17 young college students from across the district to work as full-time field organizers over the summer. This is before most congressional campaigns have started a field plan, basically. We had 8 offices open across the 5th District, 7 of which were in Southside, Virginia. And I think that was a huge part of our victory. Another thing I mentioned about the campaign is we somehow, and I still don't really understand this, if there are any reporters in the room, thank you, somehow we managed to get more press than Virgil Goob did over the summer. And this is particularly odd in political campaigns because everything Goob does is inherently newsworthy. He's a congressman, you know? So it's incredibly easy for him to attract press. I think, first of all, his campaign was not the most well-run campaign I've ever seen. But second of all, our communication staff and the tithing program we did, a lot of other stuff like that, really helped get Tom's name out. Now, even after all this field stuff over the summer, even after all these newspaper stories, so on and so forth, we had a poll, an internal poll in, it was either late July or early August, because it was right when I started the body man job, and our numbers had not moved significantly. We were still down massively. And this was really disappointing to a lot of people, but my theory is, and I have no way of knowing if this is actually true, is that once we started running those clever TV ads, people saw them and they were like, oh yeah, I met that guy at the tractor pull in July. Or, oh yeah, someone from his team came and left a pamphlet on my door. Like, he's really, you know, out there. You know? And so I think that there's a lot that what it, the field stuff and what the media stuff did was it primed people to switch over once we started the big ad buys. So candidate, campaign, conviction politics. And this is, I think, one of the big reasons why Tom ran, was to prove that conviction politics can work. What conviction politics is, back in the 90s, Clinton, bless his heart, as Dahlia Lithwick would insist I say, Clinton, bless his little heart, was big on triangulation, centrism, pandering, you might call it, which is where you sort of try and figure out what people want you to say, and then you say that. People don't really buy that, or at least this was Tom's theory. People sort of see through that, and they're like, oh, that guy's just telling me what he thinks I want to hear. And so we really ran a campaign based on what Tom believed in. And, you know, that Tom is a pretty liberal guy. You know, he's very sincere in his faith. That's not, you know, just a, you know, a pandering thing. But he's pretty far on the left side of the spectrum, if you ask me. And we just trusted that voters didn't want centrists. They wanted independents. People who are not bound to their party. And Tom is not bound to a party. He's not that sort of guy. It's more complicated than that. And so it was that sort of conviction politics that I think made a big difference. There was also one of the things you're supposed to do when you're running against the incumbent is just knock down what the other guy does. Don't say anything about what you're going to do because you could offend people. You know, there will be people who disagree with your plan. Just insult the other guy's plan. And Tom didn't really buy into that and was like, no, I want to put forward this 7-point plan on economic revival, so on and so forth. I think that was actually really important and really successful. One example I'll give of that, of conviction politics at work, was most people weren't following the race back then, but last winter, about a year ago now, the Danville Register and Bee ran an article about some work Tom had done with a group called Faithful America. This was a progressive religious group, and what it did was it ran ads on Arab television stations expressing regret from American religious leaders to Muslims, people of the Arab world, expressing regret for what happened at Abu Ghraib. And the Daniel Register and Bee basically ran an article, you know, saying Tom is spending money on terrorist television to slam US troops. And what all the consultants said was, look, Tom, you gotta run away from this. You gotta say, you know, I did that, but I didn't understand, you know, whatever, whatever. Tom's like, no. That was the right thing to do. There is a moral reason we should be opposed to torture. There is a pragmatic reason we should be opposed to torture. That was absolutely the right thing to do. And I'm not going to lie and say, you know, that I regret it. And so he didn't. And the Danville Register and Bee, a couple, a week or two later, ran an editorial saying, you know, because we met with them, Tom met with them, and they ran an editorial saying, Tom took a stand on this, and it might cost him some votes, but it was the right thing to do, and wow, that's pretty awesome in a political candidate. So I think that's, you know, an example of conviction politics. I'm going to wrap up with that and move on to Kelly Palmer. I think that we're taking questions at the end. Is that correct?
Why don't you take Brian's question?
Okay. Brian?
I'd be interested in hearing what you and the other guests have to say about it, but 717 votes is hardly a mandate. Hmm. And given that Tom is left-leaning, shall we say, how does he expect to govern, given that he hardly won that day?
Left-leaning really wasn't the right way for me to put that. I'm trying to figure out a way to explain that he's a man of his convictions and he doesn't sort of run to the center just because that's the safe place. I think that people... I honestly believe that if he does a good job in Congress, and if he sponsors good legislation, and helps get important projects approved, and does the constituent services side of thing, Lord knows, you know, that's a strong tradition in the Fifth, that people will reelect him, that people will respect that. I also, and we can get into this more later, I'm not as worried about the reelect as a lot of the national bloggers and sort of people who have a 30,000 feet view are, just because there were so many people we ran into in the campaign who were with Virgil because they couldn't betray him, but were sort of sick and tired of him just being a crazy guy, and sort of realized that his time had come. But you know, honestly, you know, they had a strong personal friendship and they were not willing to go against that. I think we're going to get those people around if Tom does a good job, and I don't think it's going to be as much of a problem, but we'll see. So anyway, I've spoken for forever. I apologize for that, but...
I want to introduce our next panelist, Kelly Palmer, who took an unpaid leave of absence this past July to work on a voter registration project in Southside targeting African-American voters in 17 counties along Virginia's southeastern border, some of which were in the 5th District. And these were folks in mostly rural areas, many of whom had never been targeted by a voter registration campaign before. The campaign ended up mobilizing several thousand new voters in the area, and Kelly's going to tell you a little more about it.
Good evening. Yes, I'm Kelly Palmer, and I had the privilege for about 9 weeks of leading a program called My Vote, My Virginia. The project was a program of the Democratic Party of Virginia. That was where it was housed. But it was actually a nonpartisan effort. We were focused on registering African American voters in 17 counties, and I want to highlight the ones that were in the 5th. Brunswick, Buckingham, Cumberland, Danville City, Halifax, Lunenburg, Mecklenburg, and Prince Edward. And so what we did was we hired 17 folks, one person to cover every county, and we asked them to go out and beat the bushes for African-American voters, and it wasn't a hard thing to do. Unfortunately, these parts of our state have not been loved on, as we like to say, in previous campaigns. And so it was a rare thing for folks to have someone knock on their door or show up at their church. I think it's more commonplace here or in Nova or perhaps in Hampton. But it was a strange thing to have happen in these 17 counties. So we did a combination of forms of outreach. We had a media effort, and then we had a ground effort. The media effort included mailings to the homes of all known unregistered households. That means at least one person in the household was believed to be 18 and not registered to vote. That is a lot of mail. It is very expensive. We sent to everyone. We followed up. That was just a please get registered to vote. We followed up with a voter registration form that was sent directly back here to Charlottesville to get folks registered. And we followed up that form with robocalls that were live feed robocalls. So most of you, I'm assuming, have received a robocall. You pick up the phone and it's like, hi, I'm candidate whoever, and this is why you should vote for me, and they go into their spiel. Well, R said, hi, if you need help registering to vote, press 1. And there was a live person who talked them through the form that they had, or how to get it, or where to get it. This effort took a lot of people and a lot of money, and it was very, very well put together, in my opinion. So that was sort of the publicity end. Then there was the end where we just sent people to talk to people, and they went everywhere. My philosophy was sort of that religious one of where two or more are gathered. Where two or more are gathered, one of my staff persons or a volunteer that they were coordinating should have been there. So, yes, there were 17 people that were paid, but there were probably about 600 people who were involved. Volunteers who just did good, solid work. We have a pretty outstanding story from outside the 5th. Accomack and Northampton were run by a couple. I have to say their name anytime I can. Ruta Vasquez and Martin Freed single-handedly registered a third of the unregistered voters in their areas. That's an amazing thing. And I'll tell you what they did to do it from the face-to-face end. These are former hippies who have a big van that they plaster with campaign stuff. I love them. And I had to have them at training and say, I love you guys. But it would be obvious that you're Democrats even if you peeled all that stuff off your van, because you can't go out registering voters with all of your whoever from 40 years ago that was running for Democratic office on the side of your van. And they agreed to do it. They were wonderful. And they said, all right, we're going to go out and do things your way and see how it works. Well, they did it my way, but they didn't. They would go into black communities in their van and do what they called roll-ups. They would see someone walking and they would pull up beside them and roll down the window and say, hey, are you registered to vote? And if somebody said no or if they hesitated, they got out of the van with a clipboard and started registering that person to vote right there on the side of the road. But it gets even better because, you know, the summer is a great time for holiday weekends and gatherings of folks. So they would go again to black communities in their van, and they would see where there were a lot of cars and a lot of action. And they'd just pull on up to a house and hop on out of the van and stroll on in the front door or the backyard of somebody's party and ask who was registered to vote and who wasn't. And more often than not, they were invited to stay. They were told by people in the family, you know he's not registered. You gotta go get him. So people would out each other about the voter registration, and they would get folks registered right then, right there. And I think they were tremendous examples for us. I've got to admit that we worked hard and long through the grapevine to find people who were connected in their communities. We didn't often choose folks from one place and send them to another. So I think a lot of you met sort of the workers from the Obama campaign and other campaigns who had come from another state. Anytime we hired someone, they were either from the county where they were working or from a neighboring county. So these folks were known entities, and we just gave them strategies, and they knocked the ball out of the park. And so I want to tell you some of the outcomes. We ultimately registered about 5,500 new voters in 9 weeks. Of those new voters, 57% were female, and 24% were between the ages of 19 and 28. That was our largest population. So that's the young voters. That's the people who are left of center folks. They got registered. They were jazzed about it. In all, 78% of our new voters were between 19 and 58 years old. And in the course of registering people, we did learn some interesting things about our good Commonwealth of Virginia. A couple of anecdotes I want to share with you before I sit down. I am a black American. And being a black American, I know the history of being black in America. That was a part of my upbringing to understand that. And it was amazing to me in the year 2008 to be involved in something where I had the opportunity to see face to face how being disenfranchised can transcend a generation and it can infest subsequent generations. And I'll give you a key example. We had people asking how much it would cost for them to vote and how much they would need to save to be able to pay to participate. And while that does initially bring a smile to your face, know that Virginia is a state where people were asked to pay a poll tax and where that poll tax was an amount of money that was prohibitive for the majority of African Americans, and therefore they were able to continue to disenfranchise people in this state through that. And there are people who still believe that they would have to pay to play. The second thing that was really interesting to learn was about folks who thought that they had to take a test, like the driver's test. Well, I was spending time and my staff was spending time in a part of the country where taking a test might not have been so easy because more often than not, we had to fill out the form for people. And so folks would say, well, I can get my granddaughter to help me study. Well, as we all know, there's no test to vote, but in the lifetimes of many of the people in this room, they were asked how many bubbles were in a bar of soap or how many pieces of candy were in a jar, and that still affects people who are living and working and paying taxes, and that was awe-inspiring. This wasn't one instance, this was multiple instances. We saw a sort of pattern. It wasn't uncommon to go into a household of four or more people representing two or three generations and register everyone in the home. It should be free and it should be easy, but somehow the information is not getting out to the people who should be participating. So the other thing I will say is that initially I was a little averse of door knocking in the great rural parts of our state. If you've ever driven in some places, there are signs that let you know you're not welcome. They tend to include a white cross with stars on a big flag, and it's not the American flag. We were the home to the Confederacy. But I will tell you that we had no instances where someone was put in danger. People were so excited to see people who wanted to register people to vote, to be valued enough for someone to walk down their quarter of a mile driveway to the front door of their home and knock. It was an exciting time for them as much as it was for us, even if they weren't really interested in voting the way that most of our employees wanted them to vote. We didn't talk about who we wanted you to vote for. We registered people who had been disenfranchised, and what we learned on the other end was that African Americans had a shockingly high turnout for both Obama and Perriello. New voters in the 5th District from My Vote, My Virginia. We are fairly certain that 2,400-ish of those voters were African American. If you understand the margin that Tom won by, you can do the math yourself.
And Kelly, what are you?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, to repeat my list, we had Buckingham, Cumberland, Prince Edward, Lunenburg, Mecklenburg, Halifax, Danville City, just the spot, not all the stuff around it. That was us in Brunswick.
Brunswick. Yeah.
Kelly. Up next, we've got Rachel Klarman, who also worked on Tom's campaign. She was born and raised here in Charlottesville, attended Albemarle County Public School, where she co-founded the Young Liberals with Brian. And she's worked on a couple of campaigns before this one for Tim Kaine and Al Weed. And she decided to take the fall off from UVA to work full-time with Perriello this fall as his lead field organizer for Southside.
Okay, I'm just going to talk to you all a little bit about our field strategy in general. But before I do that, I just want to say that this was such an incredible year to be a young person who got to work in politics. Like, I spent the last 6 months in Danville, Virginia, and I'd spent some time there before. And I think Kelly sort of touched on this, but to see the transformation that Obama brought just by being on the ballot in these communities was just mind-blowing to me. And I just want to tell a really quick story about that. I watched the Obama give his acceptance speech at the convention in the home of this lovely African-American couple, and I was sitting next to this older African-American woman who was holding my hand during the speech, and she just had tears streaming down her face, and her grandson was a three-year-old little black boy, and he's sitting on my lap, and at the end, he turned to me and he said, you know, when I grow up, I think I want to be president, and I just sort of lost it, and, you know, Obama did great, like, just being on the ballot in places like Martinsville and Danville meant a lot. But like Brian said, I don't think it's fair to say that Obama is the reason that Tom won, and I think that sort of has developed as conventional wisdom. I think, in general, people have also been saying a lot that the reason Tom won was increased turnout in Charlottesville because of Obama, which, not to insult the great Charlottesville Democrats, but I don't think it's true. There's a, we have some numbers on here of where Tom made the greatest gains, and I think it's on here somewhere. If you scroll down a little bit, the places where we made the biggest gains were Martinsville, where we improved by 20.8%, Danville, where we improved by 14.1%, and Henry County, where we improved by 13.5%. And those are some pretty incredible numbers. That in Martinsville, we went, you know, 20 points up from the last Democratic performance is, in my mind, incredible. And I thought about it a lot, and I think one of those things, what it shows, the top three places where we improved the most is what I would say are the places in the 5th District that were hurting the most from lack of leadership from Congressman Goode and President Bush. Martinsville and Henry County, and Danville as well. I spent a lot of time in Danville with the Perriello campaign, but over the summer I was working in Henry and Martinsville with the Virginia Organizing Project. And when you're in Henry County, they're jealous of the people in Martinsville because they have all the good jobs. When you're in Martinsville, they're jealous of all the people in Danville because of all the good jobs. In Danville, they just tell you there are no jobs. You know, like, to me, it's really incredible that the three places we improved the most are really what I would say are the places in the district that are just hurting the most from the fact that we have this old school kind of politics that doesn't really do anything. And I think the reason that we were able to improve so much there is Tom really convinced these people that he would be a more effective congressman for them. And that seems like such a, you know, obvious thing to say. Like, of course, if people think you're going to be a more effective congressman, they're going to vote for you. But it's hard as a challenger to convince people of that, especially when you have someone like Congressman Goode who says all the time in debates, Tom's not going to be able to get as much done as I do. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. I'm getting earmarks for people. Everyone says to you, you know, Congressman Goode was able to help me get my welfare one month, or Congressman Goode helped me when I had a problem. And we were able to do that, I think, in a large part because of the campaign that we ran. And the Danville Register and Bee wrote an editorial over the summer about how Tom was out-hustling the competition. They said, you know, Tom's probably not going to win, but I think it's pretty obvious to everyone watching that he's trying harder. People like to be asked for their votes. Like, people don't like you to just assume that they're going to vote for someone because they have before. We really convinced people that we were going to work harder in Congress, I think because we worked harder on the campaign trail. You know, Brian talked about Common Good Summer a little bit. We had offices open way before Obama in most of these places. Not that that means anything really, but like we had offices in May. No one does that. We had offices in May. We had office openings that were in the paper. We had people knocking on doors all summer long. We had Common Good Summer fellows going to church. Tom must have gone to, I can't even tell you how many festivals. Linda Perriello baked literally thousands of cookies and handed them out at parades all summer. Just everyone, like, getting our name recognition up is such a, name recognition is such a hard thing, and I don't think that it was just ads that did that. I think it was that people saw us over and over and over again. And I have a really distinct memory of sort of, not when I knew we were going to win, but when I knew we were doing really well. I was at a Mark Warner event in Danville, and it was a Tom Warner rally. It was the week before the election, and I was overhearing these two reporters talking about how tired they were of covering Perriello events. They're like, has he taken up residency here yet? He's here all the time. And I just think that's really remarkable, just because people in Southside aren't used to that. Like, in Charlottesville, it's sort of hard for us to understand. We have all these great organizations like Left of Center that are meeting every month and talking about politics, and they're just not used to that. And then in places like Halifax County, we had My Vote, My Virginia, we had the Obama campaign, we had Perriello all there asking people for their votes. And we were just, you know, I mean, we just worked really, really hard. And I think that in the end, our argument about Congressman Goode was, he's not a bad guy, he's done some good stuff for the district, but Tom can do more. And Congressman Goode sort of helped us with that memo sort of thing by not really campaigning that much. And then on the other hand, we campaigned really hard. And then I'm just going to give you all some numbers just to kind of back that up. We had more than 100 volunteer visits a day for the last month of the campaign in all of our offices. I think that's pretty incredible. We had so many local volunteers, and obviously the committees, the Democratic committees, get a lot of credit for that. The Appomattox Democratic Committee in particular, staffed an office full-time by themselves. They paid for it. They had people there all the time making phone calls. The Smith Mountain Lake Democrats did that as well. On October 16th through October 31st, we knocked on 85,000 phone calls and knocked on 13,000 doors, and that's before our GOTV, where in Danville alone we had you know, 50 volunteers out there knocking on thousands of doors each day. And I just think that it makes a huge difference to people when they see you around, when you knock on their door, when you make a phone call, especially in places like, you know, Martinsville, where it's kind of a small town like feeling. If someone, if they get a call from someone and they're not used to it, they're going to go and they're going to talk to their neighbors about it and, you know, stuff like that. And then the last thing I think that the Perriello campaign in particular did really well was we had almost 100% precinct coverage on Election Day, which I really hate it when people say, you know, we wouldn't have won without this one thing, because I think that's kind of a simplistic way of looking at it. There were a lot of different things that kind of came together. But honestly, I think that one of the reasons why we had more votes, or why Obama helped us more than he helped other congressional candidates, is because we had a really smart campaign and a really smart field staff, and we used the sort of Obama bump to our advantage. It would have been really easy for us to lose a lot of votes from first-time voters who were registered with My Vote, My Virginia, and organizations like that, because they were mostly understandably excited about Obama. And so, you know, a lot of people, when I'd be canvassing, I'd say, I'm here with Tom Perriello, and they're like, no, 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 you're wasting your time. All the votes here are going to Obama. And I had to explain, no, oh, lucky you, you get to vote for both of them. But we worked really hard to make sure that we got those voters. And, you know, drop off, I think Brian found the number in 2004. It was how many thousand?
Like
16,000 people go into the voting booths on Election Day and vote in the presidential race and don't vote in the congressional race. And I think that could have been a lot worse this year, just because there were so many lower information first-time voters. And we made sure that on Election Day, when it was pouring down rain, we had hundreds of volunteers who were out there at the polls saying, don't forget to vote for Tom Perriello, don't forget to vote for Tom Perriello. And I think that that was just, I think it kind of, to me, sums up why our field plan was so great. Like, yeah, we took advantage of the fact that Obama was on the ticket, but we also had this great vision that we were able to show voters, and we worked really, really, really hard to make sure that when people went into the polls on November 4th, they knew who Tom Perriello was. They knew that he was the Democrat. They knew that if they wanted change and if they thought that Obama was going to be a good president, they needed to vote for Tom as well. And I think that made a huge difference.
Well, I think you guys are starting to get a little sense of how many different things were at work that helped pull Tom over the top in this election. And there have been some sheets passed around that kind of have bullet points summarizing a lot of this stuff, so you can at least have something to touch on. And it also lists the names and everybody who's speaking. And up next, we've got two reporters who did some in-depth reporting on the campaign, and we'll let them try and sort out what they think were the most important things that put Tom over the top. First up, we've got Will Goldsmith, the news editor for CBO Weekly, and he covered Tom's campaign in Southside fairly early on in the campaign.
Great. Thanks, Bradley.
Thanks, Will.
Hi, I'm Will Goldsmith. So before I begin, let me first apologize for looking a little disheveled. My razor, I think, is in Moscow somewhere. My bag was lost when I returned from vacation. So first of all, there are a couple of points. Brian and Kelly and Rachel have hit on a lot of points that I think are crucial. You know, certainly it's interesting having this conversation about why he won. I wonder how different the conversation would be if he, you know, 800 points went the other way. How we'd be analyzing that, but a couple of things I just wanted to hit on that I noticed. First of all, I think we're all aware, but I just want to emphasize it was absolutely crucial that Perriello won in Southside, that he was able to at least make 10-point gains in a lot of those districts throughout Southside where Al Weed and Meredith Richards had. Gotten hit pretty hard, and so Southside to me seemed like the absolute key. When I first met Tom, it was back in November of 2007. Wait, 2008? Which are my years now? 2008 just passed. 2007, December or November 2007, and. You know, he was an interesting guy to talk to. You could engage him on a lot of different topics. but his rhetoric had so much to do with foreign countries. It was Darfur, it was Sierra Leone, it was Afghanistan. It was the places that he had been to recently that he was very passionate about, that he had a lot of probably very good ideas about how those places could be better. And I thought that he did a reasonably good job of connecting those places to lives here in Albemarle County and in Virginia and in the United States. But I was a little skeptical about whether that was going to win him office in the 5th Congressional District and allow him to beat Congressman Goode. So I was a little wary of how he as a candidate would come across. Flash forward to July of 2008, when I was watching him in action in Southside Virginia, in Danville, in little towns like Clover, in these sort of little small towns across the Southside, you would think he had lived in Southside his entire life, the way he talked about Southside. He really was able to change his rhetoric, to change the way he talked about things, to really get at the economic bread and butter sort of issues that people cared about. And you know, it seems like an easy thing to think of that, you know, of course you want to talk about Southside issues rather than talk about, Darfur, Afghanistan, or Sierra Leone. But I think that a lot of candidates have a hard time making that transition between what they're comfortable with talking about and what they still believe in, but what is actually the most relevant thing, and really kind of, not in a disingenuous way necessarily, but changing that rhetorical tone. So that's one thing I noticed about Tom and the way he was able to kind of change his campaign as time went on. I don't want to dwell on this, but I do want to just reemphasize that the Common Good Summer Fellows Program that Tom instituted over the summer, I think, was absolutely crucial to laying that foundation for his campaign. And even though it didn't show up in the Survey USA poll that still had Tom down 33 or 34 points in August, I think that Brian and others are right when they suggest that it primed a lot of people, that when they saw that Perriello name later on in the race, they had some sort of reference point for him. He wasn't just, you know, some guy that Virgil Goode could define as this guy, but, you know, was somebody that they had talked to an energetic staff member who came by their door, who gave them a leaflet. And even if they didn't like him and they still voted for Goode, they weren't going to actively go out and rail against Tom to other people. So I think that the spending the money, and while they didn't spend it necessarily on paying them, they certainly spent some money on setting up those offices and making sure they weren't starving to death in Martinsville and Bedford and elsewhere. I think that was absolutely crucial in really establishing that campaign. I want to emphasize, too, when I was out in July... late July, Perriello was winning the sign campaign in Southside. There were more Perriello signs than Goode, you know, a six-term incumbent. So that was pretty remarkable. I came away from my trip in July watching the Perriello campaign at work, seeing a tremendous organization at work, but it still seemed like a lot of others were missing that. The News in Advance, Lynchburg's News in Advance, and July 28th said about Tom, how will a 33-year-old University of Virginia law lecturer play in the district outside the liberal bastions of Charlottesville? Who knows? He may have raked in a lot of cash, but he's not been seen or heard from much in hinterland of the district. Based on what I was seeing, that wasn't actually the case. I would talk to people in a farmer's market in Bedford, and they didn't like Tom necessarily, but they had heard of Tom. And so I think that summer internship program was crucial to that. Plus, it also trained the workers who ended up finishing the job in the fall. So, and then the only other thing I just want to emphasize that I think that plays into the point that Brian kind of stepped around it, but Goode ran a really awful campaign when it come down to it. He was very, very complacent in just about everything that he did, and it was clear that he didn't know how to run a campaign against a close contender, and he kind of fell back on a lot of tricks and phoned it in, and that ended up costing him a lot of votes in the end, as they alluded to. So.
All right. Up next, we've got Lindsay Barnes, who's a reporter with The Hook, and he did a big article on Tom's big final election day, 450-mile trip all across the district to round up every last vote that he could, and that could well have made the difference in some sense, and I'll let Lindsay tell you more about it.
Well, thank you, Previ, for having me here. I'll be brief. I'll tell you two stories from Election Day. You could talk an awful lot about the ground game. You can talk an awful lot about the voter outreach efforts, and even I'm surprised nobody's mentioned how clever these ads were. That I'm sure you all saw them. They certainly wouldn't have worked had they not had the reference point. But there's no question that they were able to break through the clutter. They were not your conventional campaign ads. They were a little bit more akin to the Mac versus PC ads. You know, they're a little they're sort of jokey and you're not quite sure what it is at first. But you know, but you watch for the whole 30 seconds. But even if you remove any of those elements that these folks have talked about, it wouldn't have happened. Perriello would not be sitting where he is today. All that got him to the brink. But I saw on Election Day how well Perriello himself connected with people on a one-to-one basis. Now, those two anecdotes. The first, I saw him in Charlottesville campaigning with Cree Deeds, the state senator, now a candidate for governor. Cree Deeds fits the bill for a candidate that succeeds in the 5th District far better than Tom does. He's easy with a handshake and a smile. He's warm. He's got that mountain twang. None of these really apply to Tom Perriello. He's very and in talking about the issues with people, I saw it myself. He would spend 15 minutes on Election Day talking with one voter about his position on abortion, and he was not going to convince this person on abortion. I'm sorry. But there he was, you know, making his case, and ultimately he would have to arrive at, well, we may not agree on this issue, but I hope that we can respect each other's views, and certainly we can agree that we can cut down on teenage pregnancies, and there would be some sort of consensus reached. I saw him do this time and time again over the course of Election Day. The one that sticks out in my mind the most, we were standing in the town of Hurt, over in Southside. Tiny, tiny, tiny town, and I'm not exaggerating here, it's literally standing there in front of the firehouse, which was a precinct that day. It was me, it was, I think, he may not have even been old enough to vote, a kid representing the Republicans there, handing out, you know, whatever literature they had there, and 5th District Congressional candidate Tom Perriello. And that's it. Nobody's coming in. Nobody. We're literally sitting there waiting for people to come in. Meanwhile, this massive beehive ground operation I know is going on across the district. Hundreds of volunteers. And the candidate is sitting there. And I'm thinking at this point, I'm not hopeful for his prospects. It's toward the end of the night. And I see him talk to one guy who's coming in. And this is, there was a picture that ran of him in the article that I wrote. He was wearing a Jack Daniels T-shirt, had a goatee, and a Virginia Tech Hokies cap on. Not your typical. I'm looking here. I don't see anybody who looks like that. And they talked for a little while. He spoke very quietly to this man, young guy, and they talked for a little while, about 5 minutes. I'm trying to keep my sort of reporterly distance there. And he comes back out. About 5 minutes later, they exchange waves. And at that moment, Tom Perriello leans over to me and he says, "This is why I'm confident about our chances. To look at him, you wouldn't think he was, you know, going to vote for a Democrat, but that man just cast a vote for me." And I think it was that one-to-one basis. You know, who knows how many more voters he could have touched had he kept it a little shorter. But we could be talking about a landslide here for that. But he really, really, he gave people the time of day. And in an era where politics has become much more about fundraising and about crunching the numbers, I think it's refreshing for the Republic, no matter what political persuasion you are, that you can still get it done with shoe leather. So.
All right. Well, I want to thank everybody for your patience. We got started a few minutes late. We've got one final speaker, and then we'll take some questions, and I understand if you need to take off, but I think it's been pretty interesting so far. Our final speaker is Fred Hudson, who's chair of the 5th District Congressional Committee, 5th Congressional District Democratic Committee. And he's been in Charlottesville since 1995. He's been the chairman since 2005, but he's certainly been involved as a Albemarle County chair and in other capacities for the last 10 years or so. And he's seen a number of Tom's predecessors try the same thing and come up quite a bit short. So we'll get his take on what Tom did differently.
Well, Tom did a whole lot of things differently, and I am obviously not going to say anything that takes away from his campaign, the quality of the candidate, the quality of the ads, anything, because they were all spectacularly good, and you know that. Obviously, and I believe it was you, Will, that said, I wonder what we would have been saying if he'd have lost. Would we have still been complimenting the ads? Well, perhaps not. But at the same time, nothing. There were so many pieces to this that so many people earned a lot of credit for this victory. But nothing that I'm going to say is going to take away from Tom's effort. It is simply to accentuate other parts of it, if that makes any sense. I'm going to give you just a little bit of a history lesson because I think it'll be helpful. Back in the 20s, yes, there was a 1920. There was a man named Harry F. Byrd, Jr. He was the governor from 26 to 30, and then he ran for the United States Senator and won and held the position until 1965. He was probably the most important political leader in the state of Virginia during that period of time. That is a statement that no one will challenge. What he did is he built an organization that would make Mayor Daley look like Ned and the First Reader. I mean, he was brilliant as far as it is concerned, and he institutionalized exactly what Kelly Palmer was talking to us about tonight with the poll tax and literacy tests that kept literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people who we believe would have been progressive voters from voting. Even today, as Kelly saw and reported to you, even today, that problem is still out there. They still, you know, they are still hampered by these perceptions that just don't exist anymore. But that's why what she was doing was so very, very important. And while I'm talking about that, the Virginia Organizing Project that Rachel said she was associated with did a whopper of a job of registration of voters as well, not only in the local part that Kelly was talking about, but all over the state of Virginia. What got Byrd was the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the school closures and the massive resistance that went on in this state. My theory is that the Southern Virginia value system was violated by the stands that he had taken, and they said, the voters said, enough already, you're out of here, good friend, and he was out. The good news or bad news, depending on how you want to look at it, he died the next year, so he was no longer to be dealt with as far as a rerun on that Senate seat. A fellow named William Spong beat Byrd, and it was heralded as the end of the Byrd machine. But au contraire, you heard Kelly, it's still out there. The vestiges are still with us even today, and we have to work very hard to keep beating them down and kill them.
The next thing that happened was, at 6 years, Spong was defeated by William Scott. William Scott is the man who called a press conference to remind people that he was not the stupidest man in the, I think it was either Congress or the House. It was when he was still in the House. Okay. I mean, this is a brilliant guy, and yet he was able to defeat the man who had defeated the bird machine. So Virginia wasn't ready for William Spong in some ways. On the other hand, Virginia had had enough of Harry Byrd. We'll get back to this in a little while when we talk about the future. I think it's going to make a lot more sense as to why I brought it up. Fast forward to L.F. Payne. L.F. Payne was elected in 1986, and he didn't run again in 1996. Now, what happened during that period, and I have never talked to L.F. Payne about this, and I'm going to say some real nice things about it. So I'm not going to have him tell me he really didn't do this. But I believe that he saw his margins descending as far as volume was concerned. In other words, he may have seen the handwriting on the wall. I don't know. But he refused to throw out his core values. He didn't try to change for the district. He just didn't run again. And I honor his decision to not run again based upon that opinion of mine. Virgil took his place. Virgil ran as a Democrat for the first two times, in 96 and 98, and won with the support, I'll wager you, of many people in this room. Oh, shock, oh, amazement, but I'll bet it's true. Now, he saw the district just like LF did, and he began to start changing the dynamic, mostly his core values. He was tossing them off like the Beverly Hillbillies going to Hollywood, let me tell you. I mean, he started out in law school here, and you'll hear people who were in his class tell you. I mean, he was the most ardent progressive, if you want to use that term. He was pro-choice. He was the leader of the liberals. By the time he got to Congress, he saw that wasn't going to wash anymore, and he was literally recrafting himself as far as his core values is concerned. My contention is people do not appreciate it when you are so strident one way and then you become something else just to meet the standard of the district. And I believe that the Keith Ellison thing that happened with the Koran, and I believe this absolutely fringe, bizarro stand on immigration that he took. Again, as Harry Byrd did it, he violated the values that the 5th District had, and the field was plowed for Tom Perriello to come in, and people would listen to him. I think in 2000 we had John Boyd run for the House against Tom when he was an independent, against Virgil when he was an independent. There wasn't anything wrong with John Boyd. Good guy. Meredith Richards, excellent candidate. People still talk about her in the South. Al Weed, excellent candidate. But the people were not ready to receive those messages. But they did see that there was a choice at some point in the future. And Tom's timing was absolutely brilliant. And that's good. That's good. We knew it was going to happen. Nobody knew when. Very few gave him any chance at all when he signed up. That's okay. It doesn't make any difference. He had this stick-with-itness to get through the whole thing. And that was terrific. Now I'm so far off my notes, I'll never recover. The bad news here is, victory has 1,000 fathers, and defeat, you know, is an orphan. And that is so true. And usually it's a sarcastic thing, but this time it's not. There were many, many things that happened. I have not heard much mention of the party tonight, so in 2005, I will tell you what happened in the Meredith Richards campaign and in the Al Weed first. And that was, the 5th District Committee was completely dysfunctional. About half the committees were supportive of Virgil Goot. About half of them, half of the other half wouldn't support, they just stayed neutral, and nothing was happening. In 2005, that changed. And at least this time, while it is not 100%, folks, go away, but at least we have the momentum of the party going in the direction of the Democratic Party. And that means you don't have an institutional group of people standing behind telling you not to vote for the Democratic candidate, which makes no sense, but please. There were, I believe it was Brian, that talked about the Obama race. Now I'm moving to the reasons, okay? The reasons, there were some decisions that were made that were important here. One was the Obama decision not to do signs. That really made an awful lot of people mad. I know in Charlottesville it did, and it made a whole bunch more mad south in the South Side. But what it did is it opened it up for the 5th District to provide the what I call the three-way signs. And they went so fast the first time that we had to reorder them. And, we ended up placing 10,000 signs. It met a need. 2 points. One, people saw the presence of the Democratic candidates. But in effect, more importantly, we ticketed unwittingly, please, I'm not, this was a complete accident, believe me. We ticketized Perriello with Obama and Warner. Now, historically, people thought Virgil Goode was a Democrat because he'd been a Democrat a long time ago, and his father was a Democrat, and so on and so on and so on. And people would vote for him thinking he was still a Democrat. But this allowed people to see the ticket in total, and it was helpful. Again, it was pure accident, but I've heard many, many people report back that they finally understood. They understood that. The other one was the sample ballots. Rachel talked about the activity at the polling. We were scared to death as a party that there would be undervoting and people would walk away from the booth without punching the Perriello name. Put that into perspective. Al Weed had been 15,000 short of the up-ticket people when he would run. In other words, this was a normal event. It happened. It was real, and the concern was real. But the way it worked is we actually had it where Perriello outpolled Obama in the 5th, which is absolutely unheard of. But it's true. So, on the other hand, can you say, well, did Obama handle the 5th on the basis of the Perriello coattail? No, not exactly. Because in the north part, the James is that little squiggly line that runs south of Nelson, Albemarle, and Fluvanna. North of the James, Perriello beat the socks off of Obama. South of the James, though, he didn't. And so you have to look at it almost in two pieces. The other is the Warner effect. 50,000 people voted for John McCain. That voted for John Warner, for Mark Warner. Not all of them moved back to Virgil. So Warner was, as you pointed out, Brian, was very, very helpful. But I mean, there was about 10,000 people that didn't make the switch back, and that was extraordinarily important. I'm almost done. Believe me. The other thing is the future. We went to Byrd, and this is the reason for the Byrd story. Byrd defeat, Spong win, Spong loses because things just didn't happen. The national blogs, the pundits, look at Tom as a short-termer. I happen to agree with Brian that he does not necessarily have to be. The dynamic is going to be entirely different 2 years from now. He's going to be the incumbent, and the incumbent has a lot going for him in addition to that. Secondly, it's the decisions. The decisions that he makes will dictate so much of what happens in the next election. The third thing, it's 2 more years to build a better infrastructure of the party that will be helpful. It was helpful this time, and it will be more helpful in 2 years. And the last thing is if we can continue the effort that is going on today, or went on until November the 4th, I guess it was, and replace a lot of the constitutional officers and the boards of supervisors and the town councils with people who are not afraid to stand up as Democrats and run as Democrats, then we will prepare the field for Tom Perriello to have a successful race in 2010 and be a congressman for as long as he wants to be, which is what this is really all about. So I hope that you will stay involved, stay active, vote Democratic. Let's keep the buggers going out. Register as many voters as you can in the future. Thank you.
All right. Big round of applause for all our members. I understand that folks need to take off, but we'll definitely take a few questions while we've got all these great folks assembled.
I'm fascinated to hear that Obama made a decision not to send signs to Virginia. Is that what you said?
He made a decision to put his money in staff, not in signs. He did send a sprinkling of signs, but it was not a matter of not supporting the effort. They just thought the field ops was more important than the signage. But it was just
all the money he had.
Well, I don't care how much he got. There's always he always run out. You know how it is at the end of the week.
Right here in the front.
Absolutely inspiring, terrific information. So I intend this as a question, not a criticism, but the only mention, I think, by anybody of any particular policy position was a brief mention of abortion by Lindsay. And I'm wondering, were there policy proposals and differences that had a big impact at all? And if so, what were they?
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
We, like I said, one of the interesting things about our campaign was we really tried whenever possible to not just attack Virgil's policies, which was actually really easy. I don't know if any of you all got to see the second debate in Danville at the Institute for Advanced Learning and Research, where he just went a little off the deep end. But Tom actually tried to put forward his own policy. So obviously the number one focus was jobs and economic revival for Southside Virginia. We had a 7-point economic revival plan. Main focus of that was infrastructure, small business development, or small business support and workforce development. There are a host of other policies like that, but our big focus in terms of, one of our other big focuses was, and I guess, I don't know if you count this as a policy, but an effectiveness argument. We pointed out that Virgil, of the 66 members of Appropriations Committee, was ranked 60th most effective. And, you know, we talked a lot about what he could be doing for Southside and he wasn't doing. So we tried to focus a lot on the economy. We tried to keep it from being personal and keep it more towards the issues. And,
Yeah, I think also with the effectiveness thing, I think Tom did a really good job of showing how some of Virgil's policies made him less effective. And one of the things Tom talked about a lot was, whenever Virgil brought it up, which he pretty much did in answer to any question, was about Virgil's immigration policy and how his stance on immigration had put him to the far, far right of his party and made it impossible for him to find any allies in Congress, and how, you know, Congressman Goode just was taking these positions on these issues that didn't affect people in the district and running away from things like jobs that really did. And one of the good examples of this is when Obama came to Martinsville, the Martinsville Bulletin asked every local elected official what question they would ask Obama, and every single person except for Congressman Goode asked what Obama would do to bring jobs to a place like Martinsville. Congressman Goode asked what Obama would do about gay marriage or something, and I think Tom did a...
The question was an economic issue, and so Congressman Goode said, what would Obama do about gay marriage's effect on Social Security benefits, because it would increase the payout of the Social Security system.
That's ridiculous.
Honestly, I can't make this stuff up, guys.
Yeah, and also with the illegal immigration thing, that ended up being an issue that really resonated with farmers in, you know, a place like, I was in Pennsylvania County, so just this idea that Congressman Goode was going to let his really, like, narrow-minded view of immigration influence any other policy decision, I think was an argument Tom made really, really well, helped along by Virgil writing things about how, while a lot of people have died in the Iraq War, that's not as many people as have been killed by illegal immigrants. So, like, though we were obviously helped a lot by that, but I think Tom did a really good job of showing how that made him a less effective congressman.
A word I would add to effectiveness is, in, at least in my experience with him, Tom Perriello came across as quite competent. And that's a word that was thrown around an awful lot in the presidential race this year, that people wanted competence. You know, the man who had maybe the greatest effect on this year's presidential race was not on the ballot. It was George W. Bush, in the sense that I think people had a sense that, and regardless of what your political leanings are, that he was outmatched by the job on a lot of things, and I think that was on people's minds. And normally, one's wonkishness would play against your chances as a candidate. But I think when, you know, again, when Perriello would go on these lectures about debt equity ratios, and he was discussing the minutiae of uranium mining policy with one person that he spoke with that day. I think the message that people took away from it, even if they disagreed with him, was, gosh, this guy's smart. And I think people were craving that this year.
All right. Another question right here?
Yeah. I think there's been a long history in the 5th District of certain constituencies demanding, walking around money to churn out their voters. And I'm just curious as to how were those sort of demands implicit or explicit made upon the Perriello campaign? How did the campaign respond to them, and did it hurt them, help them? Anybody have any clues?
Well, I'm a little, like, this is not about the question. Like, I think that's true. I think there is sort of a idea that this happens. But I have a little bit of a problem with the term walking around money in general, just because I feel like there's this sort of idea that if, you know, we hire people who are consultants who say they can deliver us a certain type of group, right? But for some reason, when African-American leaders ask that, it's sometimes been thought of as walking around money, which seems like a little bit of an unfair distinction to me. We didn't pay, I think, what anyone would call walking around money to anyone. We also didn't have paid canvassers, I don't think, or anything like
that.
We had a couple paid canvassers, but we didn't. For me, like, I think that Danville is one of the places where you would really think that would happen, and it really just wasn't. It was a non-issue, and I was prepared for it to be an issue because people had warned me that it would be, but it didn't happen to me in Danville. That's all that I really know about it.
Harry, that whole procedure is essentially dead.
It is.
We got another. Why don't we keep moving? We got another question right back here.
I want to build on the question a minute ago about the issues and the differences in the campaigns. I think any national political pundit can tell you there's absolutely no question that the economy and the stock market crash in September led to Obama's victory, or at least the size of it in the number of states that he won. I didn't hear much talk, you know, until the question a minute ago about the economy and the differences on the campaigns, you know, in the 5th District. Can you talk about sort of what effect you thought the economic and the stock market downturn had on this race specifically?
The economy had always been our number one issue, and people in Charlotte, like, in Charlottesville, this isn't really understood. Like, Martinsville has 12.4 unemployment rate. That was in September, before the crash. It's not going to get any worse than that during the crash because there are just no more jobs to be lost. Anyone who works in Martinsville commutes to Greensboro, Roanoke, or Danville to work. So the economy had always been the number one issue, and it's, you know, Tom would like to say Southside has a head start on the rest of the country in terms of recessions. And so this, you know, this had always been something we talked about a lot. It obviously changed the way we talked about it. One of the things that I will bring up is the bailout was a huge, huge issue for a lot of people and continues to be a huge issue for a lot of people who felt that auto industry, you know, the financial industry was getting bailed out, later the auto industry, although I guess that was more after the election, and textiles in Martinsville, furniture in Danville had collapsed a decade ago, and there was no bailout for that. So there was definitely a sense of economic injustice, but we had always been talking about that from the very beginning. So.
Yeah, I would just say, just to add on to that, I think that when I was visiting the Perry Yellow campaign in July, it was all the economy. It was all about gas prices. It was all about jobs. That's where Tom seemed most comfortable steering the conversations when I watched him engage with local people in Danville and in other places. And I think that Tom offered sometimes more complicated answers than Congressman Goon gave. Some people were okay with simple answers about gas prices, but I think most people wanted to hear somebody talk with a little bit more heft about those topics. And I think that generally when you would see the two together in a debate, what you saw were Goode would often kind of give his little spiel about whatever topic it was, whether, you know, it was gas prices and how we needed to drill, and he would say a couple sentences about that and then segue into something else, and often it would be about immigration. And so I think that was where you saw some pretty stark differences in the way they talked about those issues. I think that while it was in September when really it became an issue, I think that, again, Tom kind of primed a lot of the audiences by talking. You know, he had a head start because he was dealing with a place that was economically depressed.
All right, well, we've gotten to 7:30, which is normally when we knock it off, so I want to just ask the audience real quickly, do you want to go another 15 minutes if the panel is willing to? Okay. Maybe one more question then. All right.
This is a comment and then a question, because I've been working in political campaigns since 1974, and a lot of people asked me, because I've worked in a lot of campaigns, what I thought as the major difference this year, and my answer has been money and paid staff. And having done some door-to-door in Louisa County, which is very red this year because I knew they didn't need me in Alabama, I can't say what a difference it made that there was a paid staff person there with the papers, telling me where to go, with the materials. It was organized. So I think money wasn't really talked about, and Tom was able to attract double the money, I believe.
Triple.
And I'd like you to comment, because I think that was a huge difference in this campaign.
I would agree, but also how we spent our money. You know, like, I think Brian touched on this a little bit, but most people would have argued that we shouldn't have had as much paid staff as we did. We had a huge congressional campaign. I think most congressional campaigns
we spent more on field than, as near as I can tell, any other congressional campaign in the country or in history.
From, like, just this is just secondhand type thing, but the other congressional campaigns that won in this district is Connolly and Nye, and from what I've heard, neither of them had much of field operations at all. They just kind of piggybacked on Obama and spent their money on ads or whatever, and we didn't do that at all. Like, we were talking to our communications
director. We had a
huge
staff. We had, like, 30 people on staff by the end of it.
And also,
like,
but I mean, we ended up in August of something of the, at the, in August when we realized that we hadn't run any ads yet, we were in kind of a money crunch. Like, we had, you know, not that much money because we'd spent all this money on Common Good Summer Fellows and months of rents for our 8 offices. And that would not be what most people should tell you that you should do. But I agree with you. I think it helped us a lot. I think it helped get more people involved. I think it helped just spread the word a lot more. But I think money is important, but I think how we spent our money is also important.
What percent of your dollars were small donations? And I don't know how you define small.
The majority of our donors were small donors. The majority of our donations were in district. Of the dollars, I don't know. You could look that up on the FEC report. Virgil, as you're probably aware, tried to make a big issue about Tom being a New York slick. He was passed the bar in New York, never practiced law there, to go after international war criminals like Osama bin Laden and people like that. Their cases are brought here. So we did get some money. Virgil tried to make a big issue about money we got from outside of the district, but most of our donors were in district. Most of our donors were small donors.
All right, I hate to be the bad guy, but we got to cut it off. But I want to make sure we give a round of applause.